So when we got into Chestnut, the old garden hadn't been neglected because the poor old boy was getting past doing any garden. I had a real tidy up there. And there was a water tree in the corner. And the one previous landlord had been there in the early 1900s. He used to kill pigs. But I've heard my mother say, when she was a young girl, her mother would say, "Oh, Will Barber's killing pigs this morning. Be on a Monday morning. Go up there, take this basin, go and get a basin full of blood." I don't think he charged them anything. He was glad to get rid of it. And that guy, my mother said, "Oh, I used to dread this. I dare spill a drop coming home because I was scared stiff of putting my fingers in it." Then I cleared up round this water tree and I found an old pair of stallions that they used to weigh his pigs on, hang them on the bar and hang them with the legs, I suppose, and cut the throats and then drain the blood. And he weighed them on there. They didn't go in pounds, the stones, they went in scores. And I had a rush of blood to the head one night and gave it to an American. He wanted to have it for his museum, take back to America. But that was what that went in. And I found an old brick path because they used to brew the beer next door, homemade stuff in those days, and we'll roll the barrels along this brick path. And they sold it to Incoop round about the end of the First World War. And when we knew the landlord was getting out, we was up the pub one winter night, and he said, there was about half a dozen I was in there, getting closing time. He said, "Well, I think I ought to tell you together." He said, "We've decided to give our notice in." His wife sat there knitting near the fire. He said, "We've been in it 40 years come so and so." He said, "I shall be 65. He said, "I was 25 when I come in." He said, "And I've decided to retire." He said, "We've been promised a little bungalow up Park Lane." He said, "We should be off," he said, "within a few months anyhow." So I said, "Well, it'll be strange." I said, "After all these years, we got so used to you, it'll be strange. I expect there'll be a landowner come in and tell all us old country boys where we've been going wrong for years." So Mrs. Nash sat there and she said, do you know who I think will take a pub?" And we all looked at her and we said, "No." She said, "I reckon Dick and Dolly will take a pub." Well, I said, "Nothing's further than my mind, Mrs. Nash. Well, I all see you'll take over from us." And when I got home and we got to bed, I said, "Do you know what old Mrs. Nash said to Dolly?" She reckon we'll take a Chestnut. So we lay there thinking, talking about it. I said, "You know, it ain't such a bad idea." I said, "They've got rid of Baker's Chute." I said, they'll get rid of me when they find out what that cost to run. I said, "We ought to have a second string to our bow." So we spoke about it, and in the morning when we had breakfast, we still spoke about it. I said, "I'll go up to the pub lunchtime and see what you got to do." So I biked up dinner time and got an ounce of tobacco and had half. And said to Frank Nash, "What do you have to do if we decide to put in for the Chestnut?" He said, "What do you think about it?" I said, "Well, Mrs. Bash whetted my appetite last night." He said, "Well, you have to get a form from Bishop Stawford. That's where our depot is." He said, "I'm going tomorrow, I'll get you one." I said, "All right." He said, "I shan't say none to nobody." I said, "No, all right." So I went up the next night and sure enough he'd got this form. He gave it to me. He said, he whispered, "Fill it in and send it off." So we filled it in and sent it off. And Roy Whitlock had said, when you get the appointment, come for interview," he said, "come and see me." I said, "All right, sir." So I went about a week, and the appointment had come to roll up at Bishop's door for so-and-so time. So I went and told Mr. Whitlock, I said, "I've got an appointment," said Bishop Stawford. So he tapped his desk. He said, "Now then, you listen to me. Put your gamekeeper suit on and your brogues." I said, "I can't go and interfere with a pub as though I was going on a day shoot." "Of course you can," he said. just what you want to do. Countryman for a country pub. Put your plus fours and your stockings and your brown boot brogues, he said, and your tweed, give all your tweed suit, and you go dressed up to the nines. He said, they'll lap you up. So I'd done what Mr. Whitlock said, and we went and sat in the waiting room and finally got called in front of this district manager. He eyed me up and down, we sat down, and he went through particulars of, you know, were we married to each other? Were we married? Of course, to each other, he said. Otherwise, they wouldn't have entertained you if you were living together. They were in all through that. He said, well, if you hear, he said, you realise I've got 32 more applicants to interview for the Chestnut. I said, have you really? He said, yeah. Oh, dear, I said, I wouldn't have wasted your time if I'd have known all that. I said, I didn't think anybody would be interested. Oh, yeah, he said, no, 32 to see. He said, I've already seen two. But he said, if you're here within a couple of 3 days, he said, we want you back. He said, you'll know you're on a short list. So I said, all right, Mr. Dunwell, his name was. So off we came out. And he said, because if you come back, he said, then I should go into the financial side of things. He said, otherwise, that's confidential. All right, so off we came. And about 2 days later, I had a letter come, would I go back the next week for the second interview? So I told Roy Whitlock, I said, I've got to go back for a second interview. He said, I told you, he said, you walk this pub. He said, ain't no doubt, put your suit on again. So back we went, and the appointment was for 2:15, I remember. We got in the waiting room about 2 o'clock. And a great big Bentley pulled up outside, and out got a bloke and his plus fours and his tweeds and his deerstalker hat. And he come walking through the waiting room, and he just said, good afternoon, I said, good afternoon, sir. He got to the door and tapped it and opened it, and he looked round and he said, are you Mr. Ruggles? I said, yes. Oh, pleased to meet you, he said, you're the one was taking the chestnut, aren't you? And I hadn't even gone in for an interview. And I knew him, he was a bloke named Mr. Bedford, he was the director of Incoot, and he used to shoot with Richard Butler at Alston. So I knew him, I knew of him, and I knew who he was. So in we went and saw this Mr. Dunwell again. He went through all the financial side of things, and he said, well, he said, we've decided to let you have the pub. He said, I now need to interview these other 32, he said, I think he said, you realise you stood out a mile from Bounderby, he said. So he said, now, I'm afraid we'll have to put your rent up, though. So I said, oh dear, oh dear. I mean, I didn't know what Mr. Nash had been paying at all. Oh, he said, yeah. He said, well, Mr. Nash is an old valued client of ours, an old valued employee, he said. He couldn't charge him extra rent, he said, but I'm afraid we shall have to double what Mr. Nash been paying. So I said, what's Mr. Nash been paying then? He said, £52 a year. Oh dear, I said, you know me, tell me you're going to double it, are you? He said, well, he said, £2 a week won't hurt, surely. I said, how long for? So he said, well, shall we say 6 months and see how you get on? So I still kept a straight face. I said, well, 6 months is not long, is it? He said, well, what do you suggest? So I said, just 5 years at the least. Oh, all right, he said, we'll put it in your contract. £104 a year, he said, for 5 years. I said, all right, sir. He said, and the rates come on top. I said, what are they? He said, they're £54 a year. So I thought, well, that's only £3 a week. I was paying nearly that in a counsellor's rent. So I said, all right, sir, thank you very much. And out we come. So he said, you'll have to go on a course up at Romford for a week, we insist all our new tenants, anybody taking an income, go on a course up at Romford for the week. You can get there and back in a day. I said, yeah, no problem, because the trains were still running from Yeldham. So we're on this. Well, I said, I shan't be able to take over till June. I said, I was hatching pheasants down the, hatching eggs down the road, and I wanted to get my hatching done before I moved up to Chatham. So he said, all right, we'll select the date in June. So they come up with the first Tuesday in June. And that'll do well. So I'd done all my hatching before we got up there. And we've been in there about 6 months. And he rang up one day and he said, oh, can I come and see you, Mr. Ruggles? I said, yes, Mr. Dunwall, pleasure. He said, I'd like to go round my new tenants. He said, there's nothing wrong, we're exceptionally pleased with the trade you're doing. But I doubled what the other one, what old poor old Frank Nash was doing straight away. Well, being a local bloke and living in the village all your life, you're bound to, aren't you? We tidied the place up a bit. I mean, after all, had been there a lot of years. He came in there, he came up this one day and he looked all round, yes, everything is neat and tidy. He said, can I look in your cellar? And yes, I went, took him down the cellar, all my barrels there already. He turned to me, he said, you caught me, you know. What do you mean? He said, you're a straight face. He said, caught me. I said, I don't see how, what you mean, Mr. Dunwall. He said, you wouldn't have this for 5 years. He said, £2 a week. He said, I fell for you to hook, line and sinker. He said, I went home and said to the wife, we got a nice young couple taking a chestnut at Tottenfield. He said, I didn't realise you was conning me like you were. He said, you wouldn't have this for 5 years. And I said, yeah, you ain't got much you could do about it, there is there. He said, no, there's not. And that first year, the game fair was at Chatsworth, Derbyshire. And Roy Whitlock said, no reason why, Dick, you can't supply the drink for our stand at the game fair, is there? So I said, oh, Mr. Whitlock, you surely don't want me to load a car up with bottles of beer and to take down to Derbyshire, surely. No, no, I don't mean beer, he said. You can do the spirits though, can't you? So I said, yeah, I suppose so. He said, well, can you? He said, just order them, put them in the boot of the car, he said, and keep them in the boot locked up and we can help ourselves, because they used to give drink away in those days. Any show. So he said, come in tomorrow, he said, and I'll give you an order. So I said, all right, sir. I mean, this was the beginning of June. The game fair went till the end of July. So I went in the next day, and they gave me this typewritten list. 4 dozen bottles of Bell's whiskey, 4 dozen bottles of Gordon's gin, 4 dozen bottles of Harvey's Bristol cream, 4 dozen bottles of dry sack sherry, 1 dozen bottles of Cordon Bleu, a Cordon Bleu brandy, 1 dozen bottles of Martell brandy, and then there was a line and something else. He said, I understand. I said, yeah. I said, what's the line for? He said, that line, he said, is underneath that line. You keep it a chestnut and deliver it to my house after the game fair. So I caught the penny drop. He said, I might as well have a little out of the company before they pack the game fair up. I said, well, yeah, don't blame me, sir. So I said, but I've never heard of Bell's whiskey. Oh, he said, there's a new whiskey out. He said, that's very nice. I said, never heard. I said, I don't know whether our wine merchant will do that. We had to get our beers and had to get our spirits and wine from Grants and St. James's. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I said, we're going to have new optics very shortly. I said, you can't get new optics for love nor money. I said, but if I order 1 dozen bottles of Long John whiskey, then Long John automatically give you a new optic. He said, oh, well, get Long John whiskey. Don't hear of it now, do you? So I ordered 4 dozen bottles of Long John whiskey. And I thought, I don't want this stuff in the chestnut all these weeks before we go. So I put on the order at Grant's to be delivered on so-and-so date, up to Tuesday before the game fair. Damned if they won a mini budget on that Tuesday. Spirits and that went up about $5 a bottle. So I thought, well, I'd ordered mine well beforehand, I should get them the whole price. Anyway, we took all this stuff down to Chatsworth, Derbyshire, and I delivered to Mr. Roy the next week, his brandy, one thing or another. When the bill came in, they charged me the new budget price. So I thought, well, I'm going to have a go at this. I rang up Mr. Dunwell, Bishop Dorford, and I said, Mr. Dunwell, I said, that spirits I ordered for our game fair, I said, you've charged me extra, I said, the budget price. He said, well, you had it when the budget went up in the budget, did you? I said, yeah, but I ordered back in beginning of June. He said, well, now all I can say is, boy, he said, you should have took it then, not now. He said, you're too late. He said, you'll have to pay the new price. I said, oh, all right. I put the phone down. I immediately wrote to the managing director of Incoops at Romford in Essex, told him what had happened, that I supplied the spirits to a trade stand at the game fair, and I'd ordered them beginning of June. I didn't want them on the premises until the Tuesday before the game fair. Therefore, I expected them to be the old price and not the new budget price. I had a letter back by return. Please pay the old price. Another invoice will be issued to you. And they issued me the invoice for the old price. A couple of days later, Mr. Dunwell rung up. I'm coming to see you. He was shortly going to retire. And I felt sorry for him, really, in a way, after he'd gone, because he said, can I see you down the cellar? I said, yeah. And we went down the cellar, and he turned on me looking at her. Don't you ever do that again, he said. Don't you ever go over my head and write to the managing director, he said, of Incoops, about the price of your drink. I said, Mr. Dunwell, I'll do it every week if I have a chance. I said, I believe in going to the engine driver, not the oil rake. If you'll excuse my expression. He turned, he came out and he slammed the door shut me in there. And yeah, we finished on speaking terms at the finish. I thought, so you might, mate, you ain't dealing with him, bugging hell. I went to a Stanwood Cricket Club dinner up here. Oh, in about 1978 or 9. So that was 34 years after we'd parted off this ship in London. We come back from Argentina with 10,000 ton of wheat to London. And he was in the army, he was a gunner in the army, Royal Artillery. There were three of the army gunners on board, and they took them off, and we just waved at one another from the quay and from the ship, and that's the last I saw of them. And I went to this cricket club dinner, and sitting next to a stranger, so I said, where you come from? And he said, Leicestershire. I said, do you really? I said, I don't know much about Leicestershire, I must admit. I said, I only know two blokes from Leicestershire. I said, one was an old shipmate from Melton Mowbray. I said, and the other one's the Bishop of Leicester. I said, because he's parson. His father was parson up here. He, matter of fact, he married us. So he said, we often go play snooker, he said, in Melton Mowbray British Legion Club. I said, do you? He said, yeah. He said, what's your shipmate's name? I said, Philip Hunt. Oh, he said, there are some Hunts up on the board. He said, next time I go, he said, I'll have a look. See if I can find him for you. I said, all right. I said, what are you doing here then? He said, well, I'll come down. He said, me and the missus. He said, spend the weekend with my sister. He said, she lived at Edingham there. I said, oh, I know. Now Pauline, new Pauline. Bill Smith, Bill's mother used to keep Bottle Hall up the road near Garwood. Anyway, we left them. I said, don't forget to look my old mate up when we parted. All right. A few days later, Bill Smith's wife, Pauline, rang me up. She said, my brother been on the phone, Nick. And he reckon he's found your ship, mate. I said, does he? He said, yeah. So he says, there's his phone number. I took it down and I didn't ring for about a fortnight. And yeah, one Sunday evening I rang this number and a bloke answered. I said, Mr. Hunt? He said, yes. I said, were you on the Hope Peak during the war? He said, yes, and I ticked Ruggles, hadn't it? I said, how do you know? He said, I recognise your voice. I said, I went to a Quaker Club dinner, sat next to a bloke from Leicester. He said he'd try and find you. And yeah, we chatted away for 10 minutes. And I'll be in touch again. He said, all right. So anyhow, I rung his old Bill's, rung a sister in the week and said, tell your brother when you ring him that was my shipmate. Thank you very much. So she said, oh, good, you'll be pleased with that. She said, he's a parson, ain't he? I said, I don't know. Oh, yes, she said, he's a parson. I said, no, you got that wrong, Pauline. She said, no, I'm sure my brother said he was a parson. So I said, well, he never told me. She said, oh, I said, I still think you're wrong. She said, no, honestly, she said, he's a parson. Well, I didn't do him all bad till Armistice Sunday. I have the privilege of laying the wreath around our war memorial. That evening, or around the war memorial, I thought of old Phil and what we'd done and one thing and another. So that evening, after 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, I picked the phone up and rang him again. So we had talk. So I thought of you today around the war memorial. He said, so did I hear. I said, I hear. Through the grapevine, you're a parson. He said, that's right. Broad-minded one. Oh, no doubt about that. So I said, what are you, Church of England? And he said, yes. So I said, are you really? I said, so are you under the Ron Williamson, Bishop of Leicester? He said, you don't tell me you know Ron Williams. I said, yeah, no. Well, I said, his father was rector at Toplesfield. I said, and he, in fact, married us. I said, and Ron, his son, used to come here quite a lot, take services. When he was at Durham Cathedral, before he got made a bishop, he said, well, fancy that. He said, I've got to go to a chapter meeting next week. He said, at Leicester, he said, I don't know whether to say anything to him or not. I said, well, up to you. Anyhow, Dolly rung the bishop's sister, lived at Els Cohen, and said, what do you think? She said, Dick's just found an old shipmate. He's under your brother, Rowan. Of course, when he said, I'll ring and tell me brother. That would Phil run late, and he said, when he got the chap to meet, the bishop sent word he wanted to see him when they got the coffee stage. He said, I hear you was a shipmate with an old friend, he said, I know down in Thomasville. And he said, yes, I do. And that's how it was. I said, we'll let him meet again. So we arranged to meet under the clock at Cambridge Station. And we had a couple of 3 hours in Cambridge. And I said, why don't you come for the weekend? So he said, I will. So he come one weekend on his own in his dolly, because his wife suddenly got cancer and she died within a very short time. So we used to go up the pub and have a few, because I mean, he was a lively old boy. And he told me one or two tales what happened to him as a rector that he normally wouldn't tell his parishioners. He said he missed one old boy in church. He said, I realised that old so-and-so, he said he was one of our local farmers, hadn't been to church for a couple of weeks. And he said, I said to somebody, where's old Mr. So-and-so? He ain't been to church for a couple of weeks. So they said, well, haven't you heard anything about him? He said, no. I said, oh, he's ill. He ain't been very well at all. Oh, dear, he said, oh, nobody said a word, he said. I'll have to go round tomorrow and see him, he said. So I got in the car on Monday. I went a couple of 3 miles, he said, to where he lived, down an old track. He said, knocked the farmhouse door, and his wife come, oh, hello, Vicar, she said. He said, oh, Mrs. So-and-so, he said, I only heard yesterday, he said, your husband's been ill. Oh, dear, she said, he'd been really very ill. She said, come and see him, she said, I've had to get his bed downstairs and all sorts. So he said, I followed down a long passage, she said, and she opened the door into the, he said, well, I suppose it was their sitting room. He said, there he was, propped up amongst the pillars in the bed. She said, look here, Charlie, she said, he's come to see you, got the vicar come to see you. So he said he did look bad, he said, and he put his hand out to bed, he shook his little old thin bony fingers. He said, I didn't even realise you was ill, look here, Charlie, he said. And he said, I must have been here before. He said, and she stood leaning over the foot of the bed. And she said, well, I didn't think we was going to keep him long, she said, but he's still here. She said, do you know what he'd been saying all the week, Vicar? So he said, no. She said, he'd been saying all the week he hoped the dear Lord would take him. She said, and I said to him, look here, the dear Lord got enough on his plate and they've been buggered up a year. Phil said, I didn't know where to look. He said, yeah, the old boy got on all right. And then Phil told me another little tale. One of his mates got promoted to rural dean. They had a letter from the bishop saying that he had great pleasure in telling them they'd been promoted to rural dean to look after so-and-so deanery in the district. He said to his wife, he said, I don't know, he said, I suppose we ought to invite the vicar round, the bishop round, give him supper one night. He said, because I hear he does go around different places. So she said, well, it's up to you, you can you like. So he said, they got the diaries out and they selected a date and they rung the bishop up and said, would he like to come and have a bit of supper with him one night? He said, oh, yeah, he'd be highly delighted. And he said, well, we wondered if so-and-so date would do. So they said, yes. That'll do me a treat, he said, that will. And they knew the bishop. They'd got a bit of a reputation for liking to drink one thing or another. Anyhow, they'd got a little boy about 7. So they couldn't get nobody to come and keep him company, so they laid into him, a little boy should be seen and not heard. You just sit there and do as you're told and don't say nothing. Anyhow, the bishop come and the bishop's wife sat there and down. They loved him well. And they got on the biscuits and cheese and a glass of port wine. And old Phil said, no, mate, suggested, would he like a brandy with his coffee? He said, of course, the bishop's face lit up. Yes, oh, yes, he said, that would be very, very nice. So he said, me mate went to the sideboard, got the brandy bottle out, and a couple of fruity goblets, he said, and bishop's wife refrained from drinking, he said, but he poured the bishop a good old glass full out, he said, and he sat there, he said, with it swilling it round his glass, warming it. He said, and then he had a drink. He smacked his lips off. He said, that's lovely. Little old boy, he said, Dad, he said, you're wrong. He said, he don't drink like a fish. He drink like a reptile. He said, my mate said, I'm going to knock his bloody head off. What else? Another one, he said, Dolly Betts. Oh, I know. He said, there was one carrot got sent. A bishop sent this carrot to help an old man out, a fairly large parish. And the old man, the old parson who was there, had been there a lot of years. He was getting near retirement age. So he sent this young curate to give him a hand to help him out. So he said, this young fella rolled up and they fixed him up with some lodging somewhere in the town. He said, do you think, he said, The young, he weren't very confident at all.
You said that one.
No, I haven't. Said they weren't very confident at all. And he said, look, it's no good. He said, you've got to buck up courage. He said, because one of these times you've got to take a service on your own. He said, because I may not always be here, he said, and may not be well enough to do it. He said, I've been looking in my diary. He said, if you take next Sunday evensong, he said, there won't be many in church, because he said, the Women's Institute have gotten out and on, so he said, they won't be back, and he said, so there won't be more than 15 or 20 altogether. So he said, well, I'm not very keen, I don't think I'm quite ready yet, he said, you'll have to be. He said, look, let me give you a tip, come with me. So he opened the pulpit door, he said, see that ledge? He said, yeah. He said, well, Sunday night there'll be a glass on there, he said, full of water. He said, but it won't be water. The congregation will think that's water. He said, but it'll be vodka. He said, I learnt that trick years ago. He said, you get in the pulpit, he said, have a swig of this vodka. He said, and I'd be surprised what confidence that'd give you. He said, and then during your address, he said, have another sip. He said, and nobody will take any notice. So he said, all right. So, of course, the time come, and they were singing the hymn for the sermon, and the young curate went up in the pulpit, and he thought, well, I'll have a swig of this vodka. So he had a swig of this vodka, and he thought, oh, ain't bad. Anyhow, he's looking round at the congregation, he spotted the archdeacon at the back of the church. Oh my God, the archdeacon is here. So he quickly had another sip, and he co-starred his sermon, and he got more confidence as he went along. Come to finish, he felt right top of the world. He'd nearly drained his glass of vodka. And when they were over the church hall afterwards, having their biscuits and coffee and one thing and another, Archdeacon was taking his farewell, and he went up to this young curate. He said, that was a very interesting sermon you said you gave. Very interesting indeed. He said, but you've still got a bit of homework to do, you know, young man. Oh, he said. He said, yes, you have, he said. There were 12 disciples and not 10, as you led us to believe. He said, there were 10 commandments and not 12, as you led us. He said, you just got a bit mixed up in that. He said, in actual fact, young David, he said, went to the beach to look for a pebble to slay Goliath. He said, he didn't go down and look for a bloody great stone like you suggested. And Phil said, I thought that was a good. There was another one he said about a pardon. I can't remember what that was now.
That one about the collar.
Oh, yeah. He said, and I had an old boy in the village. He'd worked on the farm all his life. And the old farmer didn't like to get rid of him because he was an old retainer sort of thing. And he was been a horseman. And he gradually, he hadn't got the bloody heart. He'd got one old horse down to one old horse. And he ain't got the heart to have that put down, one thing or another. So he said his wife was, let her keep that old horse going. He said, while old Charlie's still about, he said, we'd let her keep that old horse going. Anyhow, one morning, Charlie went to feed his horse early and he come knock the kitchen door. He said, Governor, he said, the old horse lay there dead. That died in the night, he said, ain't that a rumming? So he said, oh dear, Charlie. So he said, we made arrangements to get rid of it. He said, when I pay Charlie at the end of the week, he said, look, Charlie, he said, I'm not having any more horses, he said. You're now well in your 60s, he said. That's no good, you ain't going to learn to drive a tractor your time of life. He said, and I don't want the horses, you know. I only kept a gun, he said, because you was here. He said, you've been here all those years. He said, I think you're over 63 now, ain't you? He said, yeah, soon be 64. He said, well, the best thing I can do, he said, is to make you redundant. He said, you'll get the redundancy money. He said, and if we get busy, he said, I hope you'll come and give us a hand if we get busy harvest time, that sort of thing. He said, well, I'll do what I can to help. Of course, Charlie had his redundancy money and he was at home. He didn't know what to do with himself. So about the third Sunday, he said, he found Sundays were the worst. Third Sunday, his wife said, I wish you'd get out my way. She said, blast it, she said, you're all under my feet, especially Sundays. He said, well, I ain't got nothing to do. He said, when I was horseman, he said, I've got poor old horses to go and look after Sundays. He said, now I ain't got nothing to do. She said, well, why don't you go to church like other people? So he said, I do go to church. She said, you know, you only go for funerals and weddings. She said, Mr. So-and-so, all go to church. She said, then they can have a pint at the pub when they come out. Charlie thought, oh, that don't seem a bad idea. So he said, what time does this church business start? She said, 11 o'clock, every Sunday morning, 11 o'clock. Then they come out, she said, they go in the pub for an hour and have a couple of pints. Come on, have the dinner, she said, you'll be out of my way. Well, the next Sunday, Charlie washed and shaved and put his best suit on and he went to church. And he went right down the front pew. And the vicar hadn't been there long. started on the first hymn, and Charlie got a very strong voice. He roared into this hymn. Well, he drowned the choir, and the organist couldn't hardly hear what he was playing with Charlie's voice. The parson looked down and he thought, where did he come from? Hadn't seen him before. And he had another hymn. Charlie roared into that one as well. When he got up to the pulpit, Charlie sat underneath the pulpit, he said, and he never took his eyes off his parson. He glared at him all the time. And when the parson did give out the last hymn, he thought, I shall have to get in the porch quick and find out who he is, where he come from, and what he's doing. So he said to sing the last hymn, and Charlie knew that one as well, belted into it. And when they come out, parson was already in the pulpit, shaking hands. Finally along come Charlie. Good morning, sir, he said. So, well, Charlie said, morning, Rector. He said, I don't think I've had the pleasure of seeing you in church before, Charlie said, no, sir. He said, I've been a horseman all my life, he said, and I've always had my horses to look after Sunday mornings. He said, but I've been made redundant, whatever they call it, he said, because the old horse has died, he said, so I ain't got nothing else to do. And the wife suggested I come to church. Well, he said, I must say you join in it, he said, very lustily. Charlie said, yes, I enjoyed it. He said, you knew all the hymns? Charlie said, yes. Well, my old grandmother, he said, she, old granny taught me all the hymns, I knew them. She said, I ain't sung them for ages, that was lovely. He said, and during my address, he said, I looked at you once or twice, he said, and you looked as though there was something, he said, you couldn't quite understand. He said, is there anything I can help you with? He said, don't be afraid to say. But he said, I'll help you if I possibly can. Charlie said, well, I was puzzled, sir, he said, during your sermon. He said, well, let me know what it is, he said. He said, I can tell you now. He said, I can't make it out of you get your bloody good head through that little white collar. Didn't our parson come up here when you said Jay? He was a Reverend Jay. I'm talking about the 1880, something like that. He came just before Christmas. And that was customary in those days to have a concert in the school, no village hall or nothing. Have a concert for church funds in the school once a year. And then in those days, like it was, everybody sort of got a party piece, hadn't they? I mean, you knew if Al Butcher, for instance, when I was a boy, was going to get up and sing, although he stuttered, he would sing whispering, there's no one here to hear you. And everybody got their party piece. Anyhow, the church warden said to Reverend Jay that they got this concert coming off in the school early in the new year, before the kids went back to school. He said, and I might as well tell you, sir, he said, we expect the local vicar to give a turn. Oh, he said, you do you? He said, yes. He said, well, everybody's done it, he said, so I'm just a tipping you off, you can be prepared. He said, well, I'm afraid I'm not very good at that sort of thing. He said, well, we don't mind whether that's a recitation or a reading or a song, we'll do what you like. So he said, what, when do you want me to come on, he said. He said, exactly whenever you like. He said, well, shall we say I'll start the second half off? So the church warden said, that'll do very well, Reverend Rector. So of course, they all said, is the parson going to do something? Yes, he's starting the second half. So they'd done the first half and they had refreshments and so on. Then they started the second half and they introduced the new rector to everybody, the Reverend so-and-so Jay. So up he went on the stage, he put his music in front of the woman on the piano and pointed out everything. He come forward to the front of the stage. He said, ladies and gentlemen, give me great pleasure, he said, to be here tonight to see you all, enjoying yourselves. He said, you're all country people. He said, and I'm sure you all know, he said, that the Jay's no singing bird. And with that, he turned around, went and took his music off the piano and sat down again. And they said, they all clapped him. They thought, well, only got a, at least he got a sense of humour, ain't he? Yeah, I've heard my mother say that times. when we were licensees over the Chestnut, the pubs have changed now completely to what they were. I mean, everybody came in, that was a general conversation all round Nobody sat in the corner whispering to each other, and they'd all join in the general conversation. My old uncle was a staunch churchman. He got morning money for his work for Topsfield Church. He had to go to Chelmsford Cathedral and get it from the Queen. And there used to be one young man come in, well, he was in his 50s. He used to try and pull my uncle's leg about it, and he started singing one night. "I like to go to chapel," he said. "I used to go to chapel," he said, "and they'd sing old Frankie hymns in chapel," he said. "Everybody join in and roar into them." He said, "Look, oh, 99 are safely lying in the shelter of the fold." And he stopped. And my uncle said, "Go on and finish it." "I don't want to," he said. "No, because you can't." "I can if I want," he said. "No, you can't. You don't know it," he said. "You never get to chapel. You only go on what your old father told you." That went silence for another 5 minutes. Ben started up again. "There were 99 are safely lay in the shelter of the fold." He said, "I'll tell you, go on, finish it." There he stopped and he started up again a few minutes later. "The 99 are safely lay in the shelter of the fold. But one was out on the hills away, left out in the bloody cold." "I know damn well that ain't right," Arthur said. And that, when we, in the 1927 time, we had a landlord take a pub. At the time we had a new parson come. And we had Canon Lampen. That was Jilly Lampen's grandfather. Canon Lampen came and he used to walk around the village with a frock coat, top hat, rolled umbrella and spats. I always assumed as a boy, because I wasn't very old, he was a huge man, but I've seen photographs of him since. He actually wasn't a very tall man, but he was very fierce. He was very thorough. He was as good as a policeman in the village. If he came in school and took his top hat off and his stick and bold umbrella and put it on the desk, you knew somebody was in for trouble. He visited houses regularly. He knew exactly what was going on in the village. And as I say, he took over the living of Topsfield, because Topsfield living was a very good living in those days. They were on about £1,200 or £1,500 a year. He could afford two gardeners and two maids in the house living in. I think they got 10 bob a month all in, but they all had a good living, they said. He had one son who was a Royal Naval chaplain. He had two daughters, and they both married naval officers, so he's connected with the Navy all his life. But he never drank. He was a staunch teetotaler, but when his son-in-laws came home on leave, he'd always had beer in the house, so we were always told. Anyhow, the local publican was an elderly man, and he stood leaning against the pub door one Monday morning when Canon Lampen come round the corner. And Lampen said, "Good morning, Stevens." So he said, "Good morning, Lampen." He walked across the forecourt to the pub to him. He said, "I was very pleased to see your wife in church on Sunday." He said, "Very pleased indeed." He said, "I hope to have the pleasure of your company. You'll visit her one of these Sundays." Now, old Stevens was a cunning old man, that cockney. Took his pipe out of his mouth. He said, "Well, that's like this Canon Lampen." He said, I'm like you. I work Sundays." He said, "I got my cellar to scrub out Sunday mornings." "Anyhow," he said, "how did you know it was my wife?" "Oh," he said, "I haven't been here very long, Stevens," he said. He said, "but I take great pride in getting to know my parishioners." Now, old Farvey, we called him. Old Farvey looked at him. He said, "Well, if that's like this, sir," he said, "if that was my wife," he said, "there's been a ruddy resurrection," he said, "because she'd been dead 12 years. And the Gazette reporter told me that he stood outside the village pump talking to Mr. Stevens one morning, and along came Lampen, and he raised his umbrella and said, "Good morning." So he, Randall, his name was. Randall said, "Oh, good morning, sir." "Good morning, Stevens," he said. "Morning, Lampen." And Lampen carried on round towards the post office, and Stevens, they carried on talking for a few minutes, and Stevens said, "I must go in and borrow some tobacco off Mrs. Clarkson, who kept the post office, said, "Till the tobacco man come." So he said, "I'm coming round to see whether she got any news from the village." And he said, "We went in the door, Tanlap was just coming away from the post counter," he said, and he got to the door and he said, "Oh, Stevens," he said, "I think I should tell you that the Archbishop of Canterbury," he said, "bestowed upon me the title of canon, and I'd be very much obliged if you'd use that in future." And Randall said, "I thought, he'd give you what for, Stevens?" To my surprise, he said, Stevens looked at him, he said, "And I think I should tell you, Canon Lampen," he said, "that the good Lord above," he said, "bestowed upon me the title of Mister, and I should be obliged if you've used that in future." He said, "I thought, well, one up to you, Father." But that was an, I can tell you a lot about Canon Lampen. I think I've already done so. We used to get up to all tricks. I'd come home, my mother say, "What have you been up to?" So I can't lamp and want to see you in his study at 7 o'clock tonight. He once wrote in his Paris magazine that he'd interviewed two boys from the village, and apologies were reluctantly given, he put in his Paris magazine. Another story I can tell you about gardening was, when I first went keeping, the keeper on the next estate that belonged to Cordall's, Julian Cordall, he had a keeper there, a Norfolk man named Holman. Holmans were a big keeping family that lived at Hilgey near Downham Market. In fact, I think there's still some Holmans up there now running dogs and field trial dogs and that sort of thing. And there was this keeper there. I knew him because he came and looked after us, beat us when Mr. Whitlock hadn't got anybody up Pappas. Sid Holman, he got Julian Cordall, said, "Borrow Holman, he'll look after your blokes from the works." And this Sid Holman was, as I say, a Norfolk fella. He'd been prisoner of war in Japan. And he was big, strong fella, a likeable chap. I got on well with him. Now, when I went up Pappas first, I went and introduced myself to Sid, told him I was coming up there to, as his neighbour and keeper. So he said, "Well, I'll come and help you, Dick. I'll come, and if anything you want to know, don't be afraid to ask." And he'd tell me anything. I learned a lot from Sid Holman. So, through him, I got to know another keeper who'd been a keeper named Locke, Ted Locke. He'd been keeper for Rab Butler at Mark's Hall. Rab Butler rented Mark's Hall at Coggeshall before the war, and Ted had been underkeeper there. And Rab Butler, that was a big estate, I think about 4,000 acres or 2,000 acres, a nice big place. And Butler had three keepers there. A bloke named Blackwell was head keeper, and there was Ted Locke and a bloke named Ridgewell, the underkeeper. Ted said Ridgewell was a good keeper, but he did love his drink. He used to go into Queen Alexandra in Coggeshall every dinner time, had 3 or 4 pints, he said, but that didn't matter. He said, "Old Blackwell knew it, the keeper knew it," he said, but nobody took a notice. Rab Butler said to me one day, "Ruggles," he said, "did you know my keeper Ridgewell at Mark's Hall?" I said, "No, sir." I said, "I've heard talk of him." I said, "I understand he's a very good keeper." He said, "Yes, he was." He said, "But he knew every pint pot in the Queen Alexandra." He said, "But I didn't take any notice. He was a good keeper." Anyhow, through Sid Holman, I got to know Ted, and Ted had retired. He'd got a bungalow in Alstead. His father used to have a little seed shop down the bottom of the town. And Ted and I got on well together. He said one day, "Can I come and have a look at your pheasants?" I said, "Yeah, of course you can." So he came up on the rear field and he said, have you managed to move these pens?" I said, "Well, I pull them along." He said, "Look, I ain't got nothing to do." He said, I'd love to come up here." He said, "I'll help you." He said, "I'll get one in, you get the other." He said, "Yeah, well, often you move?" I said, "Only once a week." He said, "Well, I'll come." He said, "I'll bring the missus." He said, "She can sit and read in the car." I said, "It'll be an outing for her." So I said, "All right, Ted." So we used every Tuesday during the rearing season, Ted would come up and help me move the pens, and Dolly would make a couple of flasks of tea I'd take back, and Mrs. Locke would sit down have a cup of tea and a biscuit after we finished. And on one occasion he said, one year he said, my boy Jim, he said, he's gone into horticulture now. I said, oh yeah, he said, cool. He said, he show at Chelmsford show, he said. He got first prize for Shallots, he said, at Chelmsford show. I said, did he? And the next week he said, oh Jim, no, well of them Shallots again, he said. Took him to Colchester, he won first prize at Colchester. I said, yeah, what, the same ones? He said, yeah. Went another week, he said, he went to Southend, he said he took first prize at Southend. I said, oh Jim, he's getting into this show business, ain't he? He said, yeah, he is. I had the schedule put round for Toppesville Flower Show in the door. And I looked down and I thought, I haven't got time to put anything in the flower show because I was rearing then. And I happened to look on the back, judges, vegetables, Mr. J.E. Locke. I thought, Jim is judging up here. I didn't realise he went round judging. So on the Tuesday, when Ted came to help me move the pens, I said, has Jim been out to any more shows? He said, no. He said, oh, no, he got one till about 3 weeks' time, the Brightley show. I said, I see on the schedule we got up, put through the door. I said, Jim is judging at Toppesville. He said, oh, is he? Yeah. I said, what do you do with them shallots, Ted, when he ain't showing them? I don't know. He said, I expect they're at home in the drawer or somewhere. He said, why? I said, I'd like to borrow half a dozen, I said, and put in the Toppesville show. And Ted said, all right, come on, he said. I shan't say anything, he said. You follow me through the house. So we went through to Jim's house and his wife was in the garden. Hello, Grandad. He said, hello. I already knew Chrissy. And she said, you want a cup of tea? He said, yeah, please. And we got round having a cup of tea. He said, what does Jim do with his shallots when he's not showing Chrissy? She said, they're in the front room in a bowl. He said, can Dick borrow half a dozen? So she said, yeah. He said, you needn't tell him. She said, no, I shan't say anything. And we went through in the front room and there were two bowls with half a dozen, sort of half a dozen in each. I said, I only want six. She made to show a dozen. And we took three out of each one and we put the paper in the bottom so the buzz was lifted up so anybody at a quick glance wouldn't know any had gone. So as we come back through house, Ted said, call, he said, call at my bungalow. He said, I've got some dessert apples, he said, called Charles Ross. He said, Jim will give them first prize, he's bound to. So Ted went and picked me six Charles Ross apples and I brought them home. And on the Thursday, you had to entry. Had to enter all your entries at the village hall. So, of course, I went up and entered these shallots and these six dessert apples, put them in my father's name, F. Ruggles. And on the Saturday morning, I took them up about nine and put them in the village hall, give me a ticket on the plate. Jim came about 9:45. He said, I've got to go up being judge at 10. I said, oh, yeah, I didn't realise you were judging. Oh, yeah, he said. He said, I'll meet you in the Chestnuts about up at 11. He said, I'll be done in an hour, easy. All right, so I went up the pub about up at 11 and been there 10 minutes, and in came Jim. I said, well, nice lot of stuff. He said, yeah, lovely lot. So I went about 10 to 12. He said, I'm just going to pop over the hall, see if they got any queries. He said, I want to have a look. He said, see everything is all right. So he came back eventually, 5-10 minutes later. He said, yeah, he said, oh, all right, I managed, and he said, I nearly finished. He said, somebody got some shallots in there, he said, just like mine at home, he said. He said, I looked on the ticket, he said, F. Ruggles, who's that? I said, my father. He said, well, no, just like mine. He said, where do you get them from? So I said, Albert Stokes, the John's Gardener at Finchingfield. He said, that's where I got mine from. I said, well, my old chap talking to Bert, I said, he'd had him a couple of years, I reckon. He said, no, I didn't know anybody got a Charles Ross apple tree up here. I said, yeah, my father got one. He said, how long has he had that? I said, oh, God, now. I said, had it when I was a boy. Oh, I never. So I went, Of course, I went to the farm sale, got first prize for the shallots and first prize for the apples. Nobody had never said a word to anybody. About a fortnight later, Jim called to see us one night and said, we're going out the door for a drink. I said, oh, Vince, wait a minute. And I've got a paper bag out the pantry. I said, take your shallots home with you. And he looked in the bag. He said, what do you mean, my shallot? And then the penny dropped. You old bugger, you. He said, you don't mean to tell me I judged my own shallots. I said, yes, you did. He said, well, I could have hell. He said, I thought I was a rum, and he said, I was tied up just like mine. Well, he said, penny never dropped. He said, I ain't got a clue. We had parsons in the village. They're always interesting. You can generally find something or other. We had one, a Welshman. His name was Evans. And he won there about 3 or 4 years, I don't think. I was about 3 or 4 years old then. And I've found out since, everybody in the village used to try and get out of his way because he knew everything. He knew all about gardening. It didn't matter. If they saw him coming, they'd get out of the garden and go in the house. But he caught one bloke at it one day. He was out in his front garden, and all of a sudden he looked over the wall. Ah, he said, you're busy gardening, I see, in his Welsh voice. And they said, yes, sir. He thought, Cora, I didn't see you coming. He said, do you not know that the best time to pinch chrysanthemums is in May? Oh, he said, Rector, he said, I didn't know that. He said, I always thought the best time to pinch them was when nobody was looking. He said, he soon shot off then. And we had another one, a Reverend Spears. He was an Irishman. And I became church warden under him in this 1980, 82, something like that. And where the church had been rock bottom, and all of a sudden they wanted to sell our rectory, but we wouldn't hear of it. We said no. We said to Chelmsford Diocese, we want to keep our rectory. And they said, you'll never get anybody want to live in a big old rectory with no central heating, 5 or 6 acres of garden. You'll never get a rector want to come there. We said, well, give it a try. And it hadn't been vacant for long. And we had a phone call from the Bishop of Colchester to say that a rector friend of his who he went to college with in Dublin before the war was looking for a place near London. He was in Flixton in Norfolk, up near Beccles. And he was looking for a place nearer London where his daughters were working. And he said, look, if you like to come, there's a village called Toppesfield. He said, only one the other parish, Danbourne. They've got a lovely old rectory. There's no central heating in it, and a big garden. Oh, he didn't mind. He's going to come and have a look. And the previous parson had kept a lot of pigeons. So he said, perhaps you could get the rectory cleaned up. So all our ladies went down. We took shovels and we scraped pigeon muck off the floor. He kept pigeons in the house. And there was dead pigeons up one chimney we pulled out. Anyhow, we worked like niggers down there because this parson was coming from Flixton. And eventually we got it all clean and tidy, as we thought, well, it was near enough. And the day came when the Reverend Spears, his name was, came and had a look. And he fell in love with the place straight away. Yes, I'll have it, he said. I'll have it. So we got ready and got the Bishop of Colchester down there, and he was installed as our rector. And where we'd been rock bottom, John Spears, his name was, he used to walk round the parish with his cassock on. He'd go in the pub, he'd have a pint of Guinness, he'd talk with all the men as he went round the garden. And where we'd been rock bottom, within 2 or 3 months, he was getting the church full. He was that lovable old boy. Well, he wasn't so old as all that. But he used to call in the house with me. What do you got to take to? He'd come in the chestnut on a Sunday morning. Who's going to buy me a beer? And somebody would always say, get him a pint, and he'd always have a pint of lager. He'd come in one Sunday morning, he said, turn round, he got up the bar, he said, What are you all going to have? What are you all going to have? And I said, whatever's gone wrong this morning, John. He said, I had a good congregation downstairs, and he rattled his pocket, he got plenty of money. And we all had a drink with him, said, good health to Stammen. He'd obviously spent in their collection. And he decided he was going to retire. And his wife, him and him, they bought a house in Thaxted. And he gave a month, he gave us a month's notice. The diocese of Chelmsford, he gave a month's notice. He'd got 2 weeks to go, and we had a fete up here. And Lord Sainsbury was going to open it. Then we had a fete down the rectory, going to be down the rectory. And we went down there and helped tidy up. He bought himself a new mower. And Dolly said she looked out the kitchen window with his wife and said, look, Dick and John are fighting over the last braid of glass. I wanted to show my mower off and he wanted to show his. Anyway, we finally finished. And he was going to introduce Lord Sainsbury the next day. It rained, it poured that morning. And we went down the rectory, Dolly and them did. They decided the best thing to do was the crockery was all up the village hall. Let us have it in the village hall. Put the stalls up in the hall and make the tea in the hall. And John sat there and she said, aren't you very well? He said, no, I don't. He said, Anne Clark, the nurse, had been in. And she reckoned, she said, I've got a chill. She said, she advised me to go back to bed. So Donnie said, well, why don't you? And he went back to bed. He said, tell Dick he'll have to introduce Lord Sainsbury. So she said, all right, because I was elected church warden with him. So we got up the hall and everybody rolled up and I introduced Lord Sainsbury. And during the afternoon, his daughters went home and he was worse. So they sent for an ambulance and he was taken away to Coles Hospital on that Saturday afternoon. And I saw Mrs. Spears, that was a holiday time. Either Easter Monday or Whit Monday, I reckon. Saw Mrs. Spears the Whit Monday morning, and she was standing there outside the rectory gates. So we pulled up and said, how's John? She said, Dick, she said, he's dying. I said, don't talk so well. She said, he is. He got tumour of the brain, and he died that afternoon. So he actually, he's got a fortnight to do of his notice. So she packed, we said, don't, you can't go to Thaxted now, we told her. She said, no, I can't. So we fixed her up with a little bungalow up in the village that she could rent. And the diocese had ruled, the archdeacon told her, he said, now Mary, he said, there's no need for you to, he said, we shall have to put the rectory on the market now. He said, but there's no need for you to worry, he said. There won't be anybody come to look, he said, for 3 months. The next week, people were going round looking at it. And she said one day, she said, I thought I was going to have 3 months' grace, she said, to quietly move. She said, but no, she said, within a week or 10 days, she said, there was people, the diocese was sending, Strutton Parker was sending people to look round it. And that's how they were. So anyhow, we fixed her up with a bungalow. She rented out and lived there a couple of years before she bought a house in the village, and she more or less lived there till she died. But John used to, he came in one night and about a fortnight before Armistice. Sat down in front of the fire and I said, going to have a drop of Scotch, John? He said, well, I thought perhaps you'd get the bottle out. He said, so we got the bottle of Johnny Walker out and we sat in here 2 or 3. And I thought, now what have you come for? You come for something, not just for drink. And he said, you've got the Atlantic Star, haven't you, Dick? So I said, yes. He said, I should have had it. He was a chaplain in the army. Why he should have had the Atlantic Star, I didn't know, but there you are, that was him. He said, do you think I can have a couple of inches of one of your ribbons? I said, well, I never wear them, John. Yes, you can have a couple of inches. So I went upstairs and I got my box where my medals were in and I took them, cut them a couple of inches. Come down, he said, now which way do it go? So I said, it go behind the 3945 star and the navy blue nearest your chest. Oh, I see, all right. So off he went with it. And he took the armistice service with his ribbon on his stole. And he died. When he died, Had the funeral up there for his commodities, you see, and all the family rolled up. And his brother-in-law had been a lieutenant commander in the Navy. And when we came out of church and they were putting John in the hearse to take him off the crematorium, his brother-in-law pulled my arm. He said, "I want a word in your ear, Dick." So he took me out the way. He said, "How long has John had the Atlantic Star?" Because he'd got his stole lay on the coffin in church, you see. "How long has John had the Atlantic Star?" So I said, "About 7 months." He said, I knew damn well. He said, I thought, "Where did he get it?" I thought, "I bet I know. He got it off his church warden." I said, "Well," he said, "don't make a difference to it." I said, "No, of course it don't." I said, "Nobody else noticed it. Nobody took any more difference." But that was John Spears. He was a lovely fella. Then we had another one come, named Pickles. He came before John. He came about 1963. And he was a single man. He came with his old mother, who was a fierce old dragon. And Dolly used to go over the rectory and sit with the Williamses, the old Mrs. Williams, and he must have found his out because he come and asked Dolly would he go and sit with his mother one afternoon while he went out. So she said, yeah. Dolly said she's a fierce old girl. Anyhow, they talk about vicars in the village pub. And old Ben, who sung this 99, he said one night sitting there, "Somebody told me that the parson cut the lawn in the Newt." And my uncle took his pipe out of me. He said, "I know damn well he don't." He said, "Well, I'm only going what I'm told. Well, you can't take notes what people tell you," Arthur said. Well, of course, that started the rumour off. And they used to say now and again, "Anybody seen the parson in the Newt?" They'd say, "No. I don't think so." And then one afternoon, a lady lived opposite the rectory was doing her bedrooms. And she went to shake a duster out the window and she heard the parson start his mower up, and she lived opposite the rectory. She thought, Pickles is going to cut his lawn. And there was a gap in the trees, and she stood for a minute shaking her duster and she thought, "We ain't got nothing on." So she waited until he got the end of the lawn, until he turned round and come back. And surely when he came back by the gap again, she thought, "No, we ain't got nothing on." So she went downstairs, she rung a neighbour up, rung a friend up, lived up the road. She said, "Come and have a cup of tea." She said, "All right, I'll come soon." She said, "No, come now, I want you now." "Well, straight away," she said. "Yeah, come straight away." And this other woman rolled up about 10 minutes later, and she called him, "Come upstairs." And went upstairs, she said, "You look at that window, see that gap?" She said, "Old Pickles is cutting the lawn, you watch." So she turned around, she said, "We ain't got nothing on." She said, "No, we ain't, have we?" She said, "I only want somebody else's head. I didn't have all seeing things." So, of course, that done it. The rumour got stronger and stronger. "Well, I know Mrs. So-and-so saw him cutting the lawn with it." "I know damn well he didn't," my uncle said. Well, that's how it went on for several weeks. And then it all come to a head. One of our farmer's wives took her daughter down to have the banns of marriage put up. They knocked the front door of the rectory one evening, couldn't get an answer. They heard a mower going round the back of the house. So she thought, "Oh, he's cutting a tennis court." There were two tennis courts in Cannon Lamp's time. So they walked round the side of the house to the tennis court, and there, sure enough, was the Reverend Pickles going up the lawn away from him, not a stitch on. They looked, they didn't know what to do. But before they could do anything, he turned at the top and he saw them. So he stopped the mower, he picked the grass box up, and he came walking down towards them with the grass box in front of him. He said, "Can I help you?" So the mother said, "Well," she said, "it don't look as though we've come at the right time," she said, "but I've come to put my daughter's banns of marriage up, if that's all right." "Oh," he said, "yes, I'll be all right." He said, "I was just going to put a pair of trousers on. Follow me," he said. and he put the box behind him and they followed him back to, down the path to the front door, and he'd already gone in when they got there. Down the stairs he come buttoning his trousers up and tucking his shirt in and one thing and another, and he went in and took particulars. So of course that got round. Well, that is true, because Mrs. So-and-so saw him walking out on the back door, and that's how he did. But the poor old boy, he come to a sticky end. He went to America for some, I don't know whether he went on holiday, because his mother had already died then, or whether he went to anything connected with the church, we don't know. But he came back late. He came back in the early hours of the morning, and he'd got a meeting at Chelmsford the next day. So off he went to this meeting at Chelmsford the next morning. Whether he fell asleep, I don't know, but the people were putting white lines in the middle of the road near the Essex Showground on a straight bit of road, and they stopped for their Levinses. And they pulled in on the side, you see, and they were all sitting in the back of the lorry getting their sandwiches out. And one of them happened to look, they said, look at this bloke coming here, he's coming like hell up here. And somebody said, well, he ain't, he's going to hit the house. They all scrapped up the front of the lorry and he went straight in the back of this white liner and killed himself. Now that was, poor old Pickle did come to a sticky end, but he used to go up to church every morning at 9 o'clock and sit there for an hour in the vestry. So if any parishioner wanted to see him, they knew where he was. When we were in the Chestnut, we used to, me and Dolly started off, because I think Steeple Bumstead, the pub in Steeple Bumstead was the first one to have a, no, Steeple Edingham White Horse. Used to have a harvest festival in the White Horse at Steeple Edingham. And I said, Dolly, we ought to have a harvest festival in here. Now, what are we going to run it in aid of? Now, around our church tower was a nice border, all clean earth and dug up every year, so that was kept free of weeds. I said, we'll have a harvest festival in the pub, and what money we gain, take a hat round, we'll see if we can buy some rose trees to put round the tower. We decided, yes, we'd have it one Friday night. So everybody brought produce, and I got the rector to come. He'd both name Elworthy then, I think. Yeah, Reverend Elworthy. He's the one who had all the rats and pigeons in the rectory. I said, we're going to have a harvest festival in church, in the pub. I said, would you come and just say a few prayers and read a lesson? He said, yes, be pleased to. So most of the choir used to come in there. In fact, we used to, if it was a wet night, we were going to go round the village carol singing. And the very night we chosen to go round, that poured the rain. So they said, we ain't going to go out, we can't go out in the rain, get soaked through. So we sung carols in the pub all that night and took the hat round, got £90 for the church then. So we said, we can do the same for the harvest festival. So because now and again, if it was a wet night, the choir would say, well, we don't want to go round the church on a wet night, we'll have a choir practice in here. And we had the harvest festival in there. We had a few hymns, harvest hymns, and the rector gave a little short address for a few minutes, read a lesson, and we took the hat round. We got enough rose trees to go round the tower. In fact, some of those rose trees are still there, still blooming. They've been there. Well, they were there in 1967, and they're still there now.